Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome to KER Politics. Big Al is talking with one of the most interesting gentlemen who I have ever talked to. His name is Dr. John Shufret. And John is a graduate of the Medical School of the University of Chicago. He's got an MBA. He's got an LLB, I should say, from Arizona State, if I'm not mistaken. And he's also got an MBA. John, let's talk a little bit about your initial credentials, and then I want to get into the kind of meat of the interview.
Yep, you bet. Thank you.
Start with the MBA. Now, let's start. When you started as an undergraduate, where did you start at university? And what field?
So I went to Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And I was a sociology and criminology major. And then I did all the pre-medical classes as well.
Okay. And then went to med school, I guess, at a branch of the University of Chicago. Why from medical school to law school, John?
So, you know, I've been practicing and I continue to practice emergency medicine, but I also thought, you know, emergency medicine is kind of one of those active contact sports. And I thought there's going to be some time in my life when working weekends, holidays, it's going to get kind of nights, it's going to get kind of old. And maybe I should do something where I can really, you know, I have a good understanding of how physicians think and some of the challenges they have. Maybe I should go to law school and help them solve some of those challenges, which is what I did. So I went to ASU College of Law called Sandra Day O'Connor. I finished in 2.5 years, took the bar. For the grace of God, I don't know how, but passed it. And really kind of hung my shingle and practiced law. And helped the physicians when they had medical board complaints. I helped them for a little bit solve those.
John, I'm curious. The MBA, I'm assuming you probably picked up as a result of some of your undergraduate work. Am I correct there?
No, I try to go back to school every 10 years. So 10.
Okay.
10 years later, did an MBA. 10 years later, did a law degree.
Okay. Now, initially when I spoke with your publicist, by the way, I hope I'm coming across clearly enough. I've got a terrible, terrible cold. We've got some interesting weather up here in the great Northwest, for lack of better terms. Got about 6 or 7 inches of snow last night, so it's kind of interesting out of doors. But having said that, I hope you can understand me okay. I decided to go ahead and proceed with this interview, even though I'm loaded up big time on Sudafed right now. John, you've got a very interesting life. As you said, you go back to school every 10 years or thereabouts. Now, we have an interesting time in our society right now. People can, if they're enterprising, they can do really almost anything they want to. People are held down, for lack of better terms, with the COVID situation. We've got some very serious lockdowns, for lack of better terms. People have a lot of time on their hands, like right now. I can't think of anybody, John, other than yourself, who could talk to people a little bit more highly qualified. Nobody would be more highly qualified, is what I'm trying to say, other than you, John, in terms of giving some people advice as to how to do the most they can with their lives. I'm going to give you the mic, John. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's really kind of an interesting perspective. And here's, I guess, my takeaway. You know, in times like this, they're tremendously challenging, but they also yield tremendous opportunities. So I'll give you an example. I had a business called BMD, which was a virtual healthcare business that I had it for 11 years, and it did okay.
Yeah.
But we were able to sell it to Walmart in June, really because of the COVID crisis. Walmart needed a way to address their members and their associates virtually, and compete with Amazon. And so we happened to be in the right place at the right time. So despite the challenges of COVID, it really helped propel, you know, our business and other businesses. The other takeaway I would have is you know, COVID's really, I think, allowed people to see the world from a set of lenses, but for COVID, they would not have been able to use. And so for a lot of the folks we work with who are working from home, they said, you know what, I'm going to go back to online school. I'm going to go do something, start a business on the side. I'm going to enter the gig economy. because they've had this opportunity now to work more from home. They're not wasting time commuting 30 minutes to 2 hours every day, and they decided to use that time productively, whether it's through reflection or reading or school or spending more time with their family. They've made the most out of it, which is amazing, because a lot of people chose to kind of dwell on it and ruminate about it and be impacted negatively by it. But there's a certain group who said, you know what, I'm going to make the best out of this, and crushed it.
Yep. Well, you have to make the best out of life. You know, as the old Forrest Gump movies, as Forrest said in that movie, you know, when you make life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. And life is also like lemonade. If you don't, if you want to make lemonade, you can do that. You can accomplish something. I would have to guess that as a doctor, you have probably saved at least one or two lives. And that right there, I am going to have to say, is a huge, hugely gratifying thing to do. In terms of being an attorney, it sounds to me like the law school allowed you to get ahead in the business world, particularly in the medical field. Am I correct?
Yeah, it literally, like, every time I go back to school, I equate it to putting on a new set of glasses, because it allows me to see things that were staring me right in the face, and yet somehow I missed them. Mm-hmm. Either not on the right perspective or the right knowledge. I had gaps in my knowledge base. And so going back to school, I really walk out and go, how have I missed this my whole life?
Yeah.
It was right in front of me. But it was only because of more education, more, I guess, enlightenment, for lack of a better way to say it, that I was able to see something until then I missed.
John, let me ask you a question. We have a lot of people right now who are psychologically pretty down because of the COVID situation. I talk with a number of PhD psychologists on the show, and in the past I've talked to a number of psychiatrists. Let me ask you this, and then we're going to take a real quick commercial break, and we're going to go on and we're going to talk about the topic du jour, which is what you really have to do to be successful in starting your own business. But John, in your opinion, how do people, when they feel totally down and out because of something as bad as COVID, how do they change their attitude so they can go ahead and strive and get ahead in their own personal lives?
Well, I can tell you how I've done it, how I do it, I frankly kind of do it every day. For example, I was in the emergency department until midnight last night. There were 53 patients in the emergency department waiting room, and the ED was packed, and it was a war zone.
Yeah.
And oftentimes you can walk out of there and go, like, what the heck, and be incredibly just beaten up about it. But I learned this perspective a while ago, and it's the if no one's dying, how bad can it be perspective, at least as it relates to kind of my own life. So I looked at Viktor Frankl. You know, Viktor Frankl was an Austrian psychiatrist, physician. He was Jewish. He lost his entire family
right.
in the concentration camp. And he had this, he walked out of this perspective of, you know, if you can't change the circumstances, change yourself. And it dawned on me that much of life is simply about perspective.
Yeah.
I know it's cliche-ish. However, you look at Louis Zamperini, he spent 45 days on a boat with no food or water with two other people. One of whom died, and probably willed himself to die, you know, at least out of Louis Zamperini's book.
Yeah.
And I thought, gosh, if he can do that, and Viktor Frankl can survive, and what he lived through, and the countless others have it far, far, far worse than I do and survive, what little nuanced trivia do I have in my life that I can't, you know, overcome? And
John, I got to interrupt you just for a second. We have to take a real quick commercial break. I happen to have Viktor Frankl's book sitting on my bookshelf, and I'm looking at it right now. Stick around, you guys. I'm going to be right back with Dr. John Schufert.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. I got to tell you, Dr. John is one of the most interesting people I've spoken with in a long time. Just remember, it's very important during these difficult times. You can't change anybody else. You're not going to change Joe Biden. You're not going to change Donald Trump. All you can do is change yourself and your own attitude. When John's publicist contacted me early in the week, we were talking initially about the difficulties, not the difficulties, that's totally the wrong word to use, the challenges and what you have to be aware of when you're starting your own business. John, you're on. What do you need to know?
You know, I think the first thing, and maybe the only thing, is the starting your own business, is that you want to fail, which sounds weird, but you want to fail early, often, and fast. Because you'll never, right out of the gate, hit a home run. You have to iterate and fix it and experiment as you go. And the challenge I see with a lot of people who start a business is that I call them the fragile perfects. They've done everything right in their life, which was never my life. And so I got very used to failing early and often. And so when I started these businesses and failed repeatedly, and it was like, okay, pick yourself up. You know, it's the old Chinese proverb, fall down seven, get up eight. And it was, that to me just made total sense. But to a lot of folks, that fear of failure, of looking foolish, of doing something wrong, paralyzes them to this analysis paralysis mode. And if you can get past that, then almost assuredly you will have some success in a business, provided you've done your homework and you're, you know, trying to help, you know, figure out the right solution for the right problem.
Yeah. Let's talk about interest. Now, you own how many small businesses, John?
Well, I own probably about 30 different businesses in my career, and a couple of them have been, you know, well north of 100 million, and a lot of them have been in the less than zero to 25 to 30 million range.
John, let's talk about this. How did you decide to get into, let's talk about maybe half a dozen or so of your businesses and how you got into them?
Sure. For pretty much all of them, they were a response to a problem that I saw and that was unaddressed. So I'll give you the first one.
Okay.
I started a business called Next Care Urgent Care. And back in the time, in the early 90s, when I started it, there weren't any urgent cares around, but working in the emergency department, I thought, well, this is ridiculous. Why would somebody want to see me for something trivial, and they're not really that sick? And so I thought, okay, well, let's maybe figure out this thing called urgent care. And so we did that, and it grew to really about $100 million in revenue. We were at 60 locations in six or seven states, and departed in 2010. So again, saw a problem, try to figure out a solution to it. Another one was a company called Private Autopsy, where I learned someone had died. The questions about their surrounding their death were unanswered. They wouldn't do an autopsy on the person. And so I hired a bunch of pathologists, and we started going around and basically going around and do private autopsies.
Yeah.
We marketed that business to morticians who told their clientele, or their deceased loved ones, about the service that they had. Another one's called Slide Smart.
That is fascinating. John, if I could just interrupt you for a second. I happen to have had a couple of very close friends in my past life who were pathologists. One guy was a county coroner, et cetera, et cetera. I have to wonder why none of them never thought of something like that. That is brilliant, Doctor.
Well, and now it's, you know, now there's plenty of them out there, but in the early 90s, people just didn't think that way. But yet people said, well, gosh, I want to know why they died. And the coroner would say, well, they don't really meet criteria, so we're not going to do an autopsy on them.
Right.
But we also had a business called Slide Smart, which was pre-Google, where we sold medical images. We had about 6,000 medical images that we sold online. And you could order them to be downloaded, or we'd send you a 35-millimeter slide to put in the slide carousel. So if you're a medical student or college student doing research or a lecture, we have tons of different medical images that we'd sell for, I think, $4.95 a slide.
Right.
And again, pre-Google, but, you know, it worked, and we were able to sell that. I mentioned VMD, which was a virtual medicine business, started in 2010. We had about 5 million subscribers when we sold it to Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this, John. What compelled you, obviously, to become as monetarily successful as you obviously are? Just most people, when they're walking down the street, they feel sorry for themselves. They're wondering, you know, God doesn't like me. What's going on? Why can't I be like the man in the mansion living up on the hill, et cetera, et cetera? How did you break through that attitude? Because that's a very prevalent attitude, Johnny, in our society.
You know, there is a speech that Theodore Roosevelt gave in 1917 at the Sorbonne, and it's one that I'm sure a lot of folks know. It was called The Man in the Arena. And I remember reading that and thinking, I would rather be that man in the arena who's covered with dust and blood and sweat and struggles and survive, you know, and even if I failed, at least I failed while daring greatly. And I thought, I'd rather be that person than the person that felt sorry for myself. And I'll give you a quick example.
Yep.
A long time ago when I was a resident, there was a gentleman who came in and he was clearly dying. He was doing do not resuscitate, but he was awake and he knew he was dying. And I remember looking at his face and he had this look on his face. It was just this infinite sadness sort of look. It's almost hard to describe, and it kind of chokes me up thinking about it. And I remember thinking, I know what he's thinking. This is the if only look. And I think he was going back to his life and saying, if only I had, and then whatever.
Right.
I thought, I will be damned if I'm going to have that look on my face when I'm lying on my deathbed. You know, there's that old saying, the definition of hell is while on your deathbed you meet the person you could have become.
Right.
I'm still afraid of that. And so that really propelled me and continues to propel me to not waste this fantastic life that we have without trying to be that person in the arena.
You know, John, I got to tell you, I couldn't agree with you more. You and I, believe it or not, have an awful lot in common. I started my business, which was not a radio show. It was a consulting business. The radio show just happened to come along in the mid-1990s. Just out of the blue, I had never planned to do radio. I switched over to doing my radio show in about probably full-time in the late 1990s. You have to, number one, take advantage of opportunities that you see as they come along, and come hell or high water, you have to not let, as they say, the bastards get you down. You have to have a positive attitude. John, gotta take a break for the top of the hour news here really quickly. I want to get you back on the show as soon as we possibly can. You're an interesting man. You can teach people an awful lot about life. Thank you.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in time for the second half of KER Politics. I'm going to devote the entire half of the program here, which is close to an hour to, or half an hour to, Joshua Melville. Josh is a very interesting guy. He was on the show a couple of weeks ago. He has written a fascinating book. The reason I find his book to be as fascinating as it is because there is so much anger and angst going on in our society today. I don't understand why people are in that direction. I don't understand why people are looting, bombing, etc., as it was the case in Seattle, Washington. The only result of the anarchists in Seattle, and maybe this is what they wanted, the only result is that the mayor, Jenny Durkin, decided not to run again for re-election, number one, because she said we could not enforce the law. And the police chief in Seattle resigned because, as she said, I didn't have the tools to do my job. I could not enforce the law. Josh, your father was a very gentle man, but he was very, very driven in terms of making changes to American society. What I want to ask you, just in general terms, first of all, because I think that the answer to this question is relevant in terms of a lot of the people who we have in the United States today demonstrating, etc., etc. Your father was a very gentle man, John. He composed music, etc., etc. What turned this gentleman into a bomber?
Well, you know, I spent almost 80,000 words trying to answer that question in my book. I'll try to boil it down. And the question you asked me to answer it broadly. You know, what applies to my father is probably not the same thing that's applying to the people who are looting stores in the last year in American cities. Might not be exactly the same.
But do you think, but John, if I can just interrupt you for a second, but don't you think it's kind of the same mindset, perhaps?
Well, we'll see. Let me see.
You answer the question, John. That's fine. You're fine, Josh. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. So my father's case, he came from a lineage of hardcore Marxist leftists. My grandfather, his father, was an organizer in the Communist Labor Party. So he grew up in an environment of political activism, left-leaning political activism. And as an extension of what used to be called the labor movement in this country, which began in the 1920s and by the time he got to the 1950s was actually kind of almost starting to decline a little bit. So he through my grandfather, my father met famous leftists like Paul Robeson and others, Irving Horowitz, who was known for coining the phrase third world, as in third world country. And these are the people that he was exposed to as a teenager, and they had a strong influence on him. Eventually, he and his father had a falling out because he felt his father had sold out all of those Marxist principles when he married a much younger woman, bought a house in a very bourgeois neighborhood in Long Island with a pool, and wanted to put his new son that he had with this younger wife into a private school. And he asked the Communist Labor Party to double his salary. Of course, they said no way, and he quit, and he bought a restaurant. So he became this extremely bourgeois person, and my father was grossly offended by this, felt he had betrayed everything that he had taught him to believe in, and so they never spoke again. And then after that, my grandfather died before my father ever had a chance to reconcile. I think this played an enormous role on his psyche. And then my father tried to have a very normal bourgeois life as well. He married, my mother was a very provincial woman, born in the Bronx, came from immigrant family, but studied hard in school, got an education degree. And then she met my father, and she was all ready to just, you know, settle down, become a good housewife, very 50s model of what a woman should be, 1950s model, and have a child. And they moved into a very nice building, you know, with a doorman. And my father actually developed this kind of bourgeois life as well, maybe perhaps trying to emulate what his father was doing. But after a while, the pressures of supporting a family started to get to him. And then something occurred that was unique to his time, but it's relevant to the broader question as well, because it is now, that set of circumstances is now repeating itself in today's society. You had the New Left movement. The New Left movement were people who were mostly children children whose parents were in the communist labor movement and other things, and they developed their own version of Marxism. And those people ended up eventually, by the mid '60s, turning into civil rights demonstrators, and then morphing into SDS. Students for a Democratic Society, which eventually became the Weathermen and also branched out into the Yippies, the Black Panthers, SNCC, and all of the groups that ended up becoming known as the New Left in this country. And all of these groups became a threat to the FBI. They all became targets of the FBI for infiltration and disruption. So amidst this growing counterculture, there's my father, right? Coming from a Marxist background, yet having embraced all the bourgeois accoutrements of a middle class life, a professional middle class life, and now this movement is evolving that is seducing him. And so between the pressures of trying to raise a family, which, you know, there are pressures, and the seduction of a new left movement that was not like his father's old movement, where people just said, old men sat around and intellectualized. This was about action. There were many women involved in this movement. It wasn't a man's movement. There were women, and the morality was much more relaxed at that time, and they were preaching much more relaxed morality. I believe my father just became seduced by this culture and lifestyle, coupled with his ideology that he was raised with. And this is what got him to, and many people, to accept the idea that, yeah, you know, marriage is state control. It's all just a way of controlling us, manipulating us. Meanwhile, you know, this is the way of the future. And so he got involved with the new left. And then from there, being a very angry man to begin with because of the circumstances of his life, he discovered that this culture embraced anger at the establishment, even to the point of violence. And so if I had to boil down the reason why my father turned, and the reason why we're seeing people in today's culture looting stores, it boils down to one word, Alex. It boils down to one word, in my opinion, and that is the word permission. They were given permission. These are angry people. They're angry at a lot of things, mostly personal things. And then they now find themselves in a social environment that is accepting of this anger, where it's cool to be upset with your parents, cool to be angry at your government, and it's cool to do something about it. In fact, it's uncool to not do something about it.
John, Josh, if I can just interrupt you for a second. So what you're saying is that the anger isn't necessarily specifically directed at what people think it's directed, but the anger comes from, I would have to use the word, potential failure in their own lives. Is that correct?
I'd say that there's a lot of truth to what you just said. Now, I'd like to add that I interviewed many radicals for my book, people who were involved with my father, people who were involved with the Weathermen, Weather Underground, SNCC, most of these new left groups. I interviewed many, many, many people. And I think I can say with pretty good certainty that not a single one of them that I interviewed would agree with what you just said. Every one of them would think, no, we were justified. We were involved in an illegal war in Vietnam. And Nixon was corrupt. We had to get rid of Nixon. That's why we did all this. And I asked every one of them, why bomb buildings?
Joshua, we got to take a real quick break for the top of the hour news. Going to be right back. I want to continue this subject. Right back, sir. Back with Joshua Melville right now. Josh, could you please repeat what you said at the end of the prior segment about anger?
Sure. Well, you said that you feel that the anger that the radicals had was a product of their own failures in life. And what I was responding with was I interviewed many, many radicals, and I asked every one of them, why bomb buildings? Why do all this angry stuff? Why not just protest? You know, protesting is how we generally resolve things in this country. That's the democratic process. And they all felt the same way. They all had the same answer. They all would have disagreed that it was personal anger that had to do with them personally. All of them would have externalized and said, no, this was because Nixon was corrupt. We had to get rid of Nixon, and America was involved in an illegal war. And that never resonated with me, because all wars end. And most of these bombings that took place in 1969 and 1970. This was when Nixon had 3 years left on his second term. And so sometimes I would push back and say, wait a second, you bombed buildings, you sacrificed your life and liberty and potentially injuring others, get rid of a president that would be out of office anyway in the next 3 years.
And what answer did you get, John? What answer did you get?
They kind of just looked at me like as if I didn't get it. And maybe I don't, you know, but I didn't get it. And what I was starting to realize was in my viewpoint, a lot of their actions were, as you said, results of their own personal agendas. Their war against the state was a personal war. They may have externalized it and come up with rationalizations like Nixon was corrupt, America was involved in an illegal war. They may have come up with all of these rationalizations, but each of them, in my view, would have found some other thing to be upset and angry about were those circumstances not in place. And I think history now proves that I'm right, because what we're experiencing right now over the last year with, you know, so-called peaceful protests in Wisconsin and Seattle and other cities, we're not in an illegal war now. So what's the excuse now to loot stores? And of course, they have one. You know, they always have one. No one ever just wakes up and says, no, I'm just an angry, you know, asshole. Excuse me, I don't know if I can use that word. And yeah, I'm just going to go loot stores because I want a TV, because I'm just pissed off at my parents, because I'm upset with this. I have so much student debt and I'm overeducated and can't get a decent job. No one wakes up and says, I'm going to destroy society because of that. They have to find some other socially acceptable reason to do it. In the 60s, it was Nixon in Vietnam. Now it's, you know, Trump and...
Right. Josh, let me go back and ask you another question that I think is very, very relevant here. What's your opinion about some type of perhaps conspiracy or organization behind this movement right now, the movement of violence that's going on in society today? Got an opinion on that?
I do. And I don't think, I wouldn't use the word conspiracy, because that automatically conjures up, you know, notions of people being overly paranoid. It is not a conspiracy. It is a fact that all of these organizations, including the ones in the 60s, right up to the ones today, pay professional organizers and instigators to gather crowds and motivate them to protest. In fact, many times if you were in a major city, if you were to walk past the picket line for a restaurant, for example, restaurant union striking because they don't like the restaurant's policy or something like that, most of those protesters are paid. They're paid protesters. And I know this because I had friends who did it. I know this because I was offered the opportunity to do it. It's a job. They get paid a decent amount of money, $25, $30 an hour to work a protest line. Most of these same people, if they decide to make a career out of it, will end up moving into organizing protests, rallies, and, of course, ultimately, insurrections.
Josh, who's paying them?
Well, that's a good question. That I don't know the answer to. But clearly, I know somebody is.
Okay.
You have to follow the money to get that answer. I mean, I could serve up the, you know, the answer that you hear being served up on Fox News all the time, George Soros. But I don't know that for a fact. That's just
right.
Something I hear.
Right. Good point. Thank you. Continue, Josh. Thank you.
Sure. So it's not a conspiracy theory. It's a business. And whatever the agenda is behind these protests, the agenda is being served by having professionals who organize and rally. And some have more talent than others. And, of course, the more talented ones get paid more. Now, that doesn't mean that these people aren't true believers. Don't get me wrong. It's not like I'm saying they hire in salespeople, you know, or ex-Wall Street brokers, you know, to rally people in the streets. The people who they hire are motivated ideologically as well, not just by money. But not all of them. Some people are just very good at what they do. So you have a movement that is being financed by unseen forces that are difficult to trace. I'm sure if someone decided to audit BLM, which is the only organization that we can identify that's an actual incorporated entity as opposed to Antifa, which is just a loose affiliation. I'm sure if you manage to audit BLM, you'd probably find that they're being financed, you know, by someone who has an agenda behind what's happening, behind disruption.
That's absolutely a fascinating statement, Joshua. That's what was happening when your dad was in the business, so to speak. And I believe that's true. Okay, a little different. Well, how's it different?
Well, because it's much more organized now, it's much more corporatized now. Back then, the people who were financing protests were not necessarily a covert cabal of anarchists. They were, most of the people who were involved were came from privilege. So most of the people in the Weather Underground came from privilege. The famous townhouse in downtown New York that was blown up when weathermen blew themselves up when they were making bombs. This was in 1970, I believe. The townhouse, one of the weathermen who lived in that townhouse, her father owned the townhouse. He was wealthy. So the people back then came from money, and a lot of the financing for the New Left came from people who were actually in the New Left who were true believers. Today, I'm not sure that that same truth exists. Today, I do think you have people who are bad actors within those organizations who aren't necessarily true believers, who are in it for the agenda or in it for the money. So that's the difference.
Why would somebody be in it for the agenda, Josh?
They're Marxists.
Okay. That's a pretty simple, that's a very simple answer and probably very accurate. Go ahead and expound on that one.
Well, they believe in Marxist philosophy, and like my father did. My father was a big Marxist. They believe that the end justifies the means. They believe in revolution. They believe that imperialism and capitalism is always bad. There's really very little nuance in their philosophies. And I've had discussions with many, you know, matured Marxists. So the people that I spoke with who were radicals in my father's cell and other New Left groups, when I interviewed them, they were in well into their 40s. Okay? Mm-hmm. So ironically, a lot of them had kind of transitioned into more bourgeois lifestyles. Some of them admitted, yes, you know, I would have been called a reactionary by someone in their 20s, you know, back in 1969. Now they, you know, lived in townhouses and drove BMWs and sent their kids to private school. So I found that particularly ironic. But it helped me understand why they all felt my father was a hero, because my father did not come from that. My father came from North Tonawanda, upstate New York. You know, he came from, I guess, what some people would call white trash. And he went into the movement without the safety net that a lot of his compadres went into the movement with. His comrades and friends and people that he conspired with, they all came from some privilege, and their families could afford to hire decent lawyers and get them off charges. My father had just that privilege.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to make you an offer right now that I don't think you can refuse. Just call me Vito Caroloni. Here's the offer. Any questions that you have, I think Joshua Melville has brought up some very, very prudent points. And what I would like to say is this, if you have any questions at all for Josh regarding anything that he has said, regarding anything that I have said, I'd like you to file those questions on the blog. I personally will call Joshua up, get him back on the show, and all of those questions will be answered. The only thing I would like you to do is please identify where you're coming from. Don't need a real name. All I need to know is, did you get this information from the radio show? Joshua, thank you so much, Mr. Melville. Appreciate it.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.